principle of perpetual commotion. Okay, in other words, they're constantly kind of just restless. You get guys that sit still sometimes when they seem a real challenge. So we bear those things into veto. You can.
But what point is she trying to make in the book?
Well, you're talking about Christina Hoff Summers. Wait until I finish the lecture and you might know. If that's okay. Yeah. But by all means, at the end, if it's not clear, then by all means, pick me up. Okay. So, approaches and definitions. Here's a start. This is what we're going to try and do. If you're trying to analyse culture or cultural factors from a Christian viewpoint, it seems to me there are three steps you need to take. A, you need to understand it on its own terms. So in other words, you need to hear the voices of those in culture who are saying things, in this case about boys and about masculinity. We need to understand exactly what they're saying. That's the first step. So we don't even start with, I have a biblical grid and I'm going to impose that right from the start. No, we actually say, let me just hear these people on their own terms. Then secondly, we at that point bring in a biblical grid to expose its flawed thinking. That's step two. And then step three is to seek to redeem it for Christ. To redeem those elements of it that will be truth laden and transport across. Now why am I saying that? I'm saying that because it seems to me that's the way you need to engage with people. You don't start by, let's imagine you're having an evangelistic conversation. You would never start by downloading your biblical material in a one-to-one conversation now. You would start by trying to hear what they're saying, thinking through what they're saying, understanding what they're saying, helping them to see where there are flaws in it, and then redeeming it. Can you see? So as a process. It's not a preaching process here now, okay? It's an engagement with culture and an engagement with individuals that I'm trying to talk about. And it's the first two, the A and B, that we're going to do today and the C that we're going to do tomorrow. Okay then. So let's try and think now about a definition. That's the approach, ABC. What about a definition? What does the word masculine mean? You know, what is it to be masculine? Okay? Or, another way of asking the same question, what exactly is manhood? What do we mean by that word? Okay. Well, you go to the dictionaries, as I did, and you get an incredible... I've gone for the simplest definitions, but they're fairly representative. You get something like this. The American Heritage Dictionary on Masculinity tells us it is, one, the quality or condition of being masculine. Two, something traditionally considered to be characteristic of a male. Okay? Or, if I look for manhood, this is WordNet definition, the state of being a man. Manly qualities. Now, I don't know whether you've noticed anything about those definitions, but they are remarkably unhelpful. Aren't they? Precisely because they don't actually tell you what you're looking for, which is, what does it mean to be masculine? What is traditionally considered to be characteristic of a male? What are manly qualities? What is the state of being a man? That's, all of those questions are begged by those definitions. And I can assure you that in giving you a fuller kind of version of that, those things were not unpacked. And I think that is indicative of a certain nervousness in our culture to actually spell out what manhood is or what masculinity involves. People are scared. Andy?
Did anyone find a final answer to that?
No. Good question, but no. Not in the definition that I look for, anyway. Thank you. So, I want to take you back, therefore, in your thinking about 100 years ago. Because 100 years ago, you would not have had definitions like this. You would have had clear assertions with detail about what it meant to be masculine or the state of manhood or male or whatever word you want to use. No doubt at all. So one writer, for example, at the turn of the 20th century, well, let me pull all three down and this will help you then. Here's what one writer said. They said that masculinity is a perfect blending of physical strength and moral purity. Now, we may disagree with it, but the point is we have some idea straight away of what, therefore, masculine qualities are, don't we? We know it's about strength in some shape or form, physical, and we're talking about moral purity as well, engaging on a perfect level. Right? Or, try this. Teddy Roosevelt, 1900s, early 1900s, said this: a man must not be a coward or a weakling, a bully, a shirk, that means someone that is lazy, or a prig, that means someone that's stuck up. He must work hard and play hard. He must be clean-minded and clean-lived, and able to hold his own under all circumstances and against all comers. So straight away there's content there about what it meant to be a man. Or, you remember Shackleton's famous advert for the trip to the Antarctic? Men wanted. Or, hazardous journey. Small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return, doubtful. So straight away, there's an appeal to something seen as being essentially masculine or male being made here. Okay? So there was not that kind of confusion earlier on. Whereas now, people are afraid to define masculinity, afraid to say what manhood is, and there's a good reason for that. Okay? But before we look at some of the detail, I just want you to note, it seems to me, at the turn of the 21st century, so 100 years on from these quotes, masculinity as a concept is under fire. Okay, I'm going to try and prove that to you throughout this session. Okay? And to appreciate just how serious this is, we need to make a vital distinction. So here's the distinction coming in now. In dealing with the alarming rise of, say, ASBOs, the growing number of children who are underachieving at school, various authorities are noting the preponderance of boys and young men in both groups of those who are serious offenders in either of those categories. And from this, a conclusion is drawn, and it is this conclusion that I want to hammer away at and try and critique. And this is the conclusion. Masculinity per se, so masculinity as a concept, masculinity as a state, is seen as the source of the problem. So, answer to the issue of masculinity and the way it's viewed is men are a problem. Masculinity as a state is a problem that has got to be solved. Okay? That's very important we get that, because I think that's what's going on. I think that's a message that many boys at school receive, as again I hope to prove in time. Listen to Christine Hoff Sommers at this point. This is the quote in the introduction to her book. She's interesting, by the way, because she started life as a feminist and has shifted right the way over. Okay, so very interesting. This is what she says. This book tells us, so tells how it has become fashionable to attribute pathology, that means disease, disorder, to millions of healthy male children. It is a story of how we are turning against boys and forgetting a simple truth, that the energy, competitiveness and corporal daring of normal, decent males is responsible for much of what is right in the world. Okay, so can you see what she's saying? It's masculinity that's under attack, and it totally ignores much of what is good coming out of manhood or masculine states. And we've got to get that. We've got to understand that to understand the nature of the problem. Because what she's saying is it's not the percentage of the male population responsible for crime and appalling attitudes who are the focus of concern and remedial action. If it was the criminal element, so to speak, of masculinity that were receiving attention, that's quite legitimate, obviously. That's not the issue that we're dealing with here. So let's not confuse that. Okay? It is the very conditional masculinity that is seen as a pathology and that is being dealt with. Can you see the difference? Very, very important we get that. And one educationalist, one teacher, has really got this right when he writes this, quotes, "Boys' aggressive and rationalist nature has been redefined by educators as a behavioural disorder." That's it, in a nutshell. That's what we're trying to deal with here. That's what your young guys are growing up with at school. That's what they're hearing from the media. Those are the messages that a good number of them are receiving. And indeed, maybe you've received those and grown up with those.
That's not the I think that's what they hear in church as well.
Could well be.
I think, you know, things like parents and maybe slightly older people not willing to let boys be bored.
Yeah, absolutely. Point taken. We'll move on. Yeah.
So, if you tie in with this, the rising diagnosis of ADHD and the rising prescription of Ritalin.
Yep. The over prescription of Ritalin. And the over-diagnosis of ADHD. So it's not to say that there's one there isn't a problem which may be treated by drugs suitably. This is an over-diagnosed problem which ignores the nub of the issue. So just label it, give it drugs, and you've dealt with it. But you haven't actually. Okay. So why do we have this problem then? If that analysis is correct, and I'm hoping to prove it to you, as I said, but I've stated it out at the outset, that's where I'm going. Then why have we got there? Well, the first answer is feminism. Now, I don't want you to mishear me on feminism. I'm not wanting to say that everything that feminists have ever said or everything that feminism stands for is evil or wrong. I'm not saying that. Okay? There are some necessary and even some helpful things the feminist movement said. However, it has to be said that certain branches of feminism are responsible for this kind of situation that we've got when it comes to masculinity and manhood. So, let's give you some quotes to again show you what I mean. Here you go. To be male is to be a kind of idiot. Crime and coercion are sustained by men. Men are from another planet, sent here by spaceships to copulate with female earthlings and propagate species, a task to which science has rendered them all but redundant. We need only a handful of donors on a sperm farm for that purpose, where they can exist on pizza and beer and Playboy magazine. How can we make a hard and fast distinction between normal and criminal when both are located along the same spectrum that we call man? And there are so-called male feminists who add their voice. Those are all feminist quotes, okay, from feminist writers. But there are also male feminists who add their voice to this chorus. In teaching a course on quotes, not over the page yet, sorry, in teaching a course on quotes, gender violence prevention. So get this, okay? This is gender violence prevention. So at this point in the course, we haven't identified which gender we're talking about, if any. Gender violence prevention, okay? A male feminist described it as, here's the quote, the patriarchal universal discourse. So, all violence is part of the normal discourse of men, is what he's saying. That's the way they normally operate, okay? So if we're dealing with violence, we're going to be dealing with men, automatically. No mention of women, no mention of harm done to either other women by women, or indeed assaults by women on their husbands or partners. Just doesn't even occur in the thinking or the equation. So feminism has a lot to answer for in terms of what it has sown, okay, to men. But then over the page there's another area, and that is education. And the reason I single out education is because what has happened is this. I need to just very quickly explain the process for you. Along come feminist writers and others who have deep concerns about the way girls and women are mistreated, and also deep concerns about the way boys and men behave. Their ideas are propagated through various governments of both political persuasions in this country, in this case, okay, which is then enshrined into law, which then feeds out into education. So that's the process. So even though many feminists, indeed I think it's fair to say, are beginning to express great concern about what's happening to men, the system, if I can call it that, the political system in this country, the educational system in this country, is still lagging behind that kind of identification, is still adopting and pursuing those early ideas of what I would call discrimination against the male species. So bear that in mind when we look at education. Because you see, one of the earliest complaints by the feminists was that the system of education clearly favoured boys over girls. For boys, with their naturally competitive nature, a system relying on one or two exams, which could be crammed for at the last minute, was highly effective. It appealed to their nature. Whilst girls could also compete along the same lines, they enjoyed other characteristics which went unrewarded. In particular, their conscientious attention to detail and their willingness to spend hours in ensuring work was presented neatly. The solution was to introduce teaching methods which clearly favour girls. Thus, competitiveness has been replaced by cooperation with achievement through final and end exams by syllabi, assessed by coursework as a key component. In other words, the coursework element has been a growing element in education which favours the way girls learn. It's as simple as that. That is, by the way, that is not contentious. You won't find an educational researcher that would deny what I've just said. They would say, that's absolutely right, and we're quite happy with that. And the inclusion of coursework has led one educational analyst to argue as follows, and you've got the quote there. GCSE places a heavy premium on clerical or other skills which are incidental to intellectual achievement, so in other words, they're not a measure necessarily of intellectual achievement, but in which girls show a marked advantage. This guy's not a Christian. He's just observing the way the brain operates and learning occurs. And indeed, a survey of the four leading universities identified the fact that such an approach to learning is indeed best suited to girls. No question. So, it's hardly surprising that one of the places boys feel like the second sex is the school system. Look at the stats that I'm giving you there, the facts and stats. When it comes to reading, at age 7, girls are 5 months ahead of boys. By age 11, the gap has increased to 9 months. By age 14, the gap has widened to 18 months. Maths. At ages 7 and 11, girls and boys are achieving the same standard. By age 14, boys are 2 months ahead of girls. Overall grades at 16. From 1955 to 1968, boys outperformed girls by 5%. From 1970 to 1985, boys and girls performed at broadly the same level. From 1987 to 2000, girls outperformed boys by 20%. So who are the new disadvantaged? This is interesting. This has only come out recently. Not just boys in general now, but a very specific group of boys. Just 17% of white working class boys achieved 5 good grade GCSEs. 2% fewer than black boys, and far below those from Indian and Chinese backgrounds. Interesting. And in 2006, the latest government report found that the situation had not improved. Boys are now trailing 7 years behind girls at GCSE level in terms of the 5 good passes criteria. Okay. Interestingly, the government commissioned a report way back in 1999 called Leading Lads. It found that, quotes, I'm afraid I haven't given this quote, but just listen, boys dominate amongst the excluded, the remedial classes, the special needs classes, and the temporarily excluded. Some suggest that there are as many as 3 times as many boys as girls, either excluded or in special schools. What is indisputable is that at secondary level, where pupils are more than 7 times more likely to be excluded than primary schools, boys account for 83% of the total permanent exclusions. It seems that for those boys unable to fit in with the new educational orthodoxy, the best resort is to antisocial behaviour such as bullying, or to exalt in failure as a symbol of masculinity. Yes, I failed. Yes, I've been excluded. That kind of response is one of the responses that many in that 17%, that white working class male group, have only recently been identified as the problem. Okay, so there's education, but there's also other areas. There's work and family. The competitive masculine drive means that men need to have a goal in life. which they find both challenging but also achievable. One obvious way they would do this in the past was by holding down a job and providing for their family. That was always seen as a kind of natural male thing to do. Even Margaret Mead, and Margaret Mead was no friend of any Judeo-Christian values. She was an anthropologist writing in the 1940s. Even she said this, and you've got it there, in every known human society, everywhere in the world, the young male learns that when he grows up, one of the things which he must do is to provide food for some female or her young. Okay. So let's look at work. The number of men in work in 1998 was 4% lower than it had been in 1990. At the same time, the number of women in work rose by 1%. Not dramatic, but nevertheless a rise rather than a fall. The reason for this, of course, was the collapse of the manufacturing industries in Britain and the rise in lower paid part-time work, often in the service sector. Okay? So we know why it happened. Yet for a man, this is what I want to emphasise, work represents more than a wage. It represents his ability to provide for himself and any in his care. So it's not surprising that unemployment for men is literally devastating in a way that it isn't for women. It strikes at their core value. Secondly, family. As I've already said, one of the key sets of people who men find fulfillment providing for is indeed their family. Yet, consistent government policies since the late 1960s built on the notion that women need to work in order to be independent from men have encouraged increasing numbers of women back into the workplace, so threatening men's jobs, and established state childcare for any children. That's where we're going now. State childcare for any children. Just think of that. That is an amazing concept that we import into the culture. The state nurturing a child. What have we come to? How can the state nurture a child? But that is what is increasingly encouraged in terms of political policy. So in all of that, what is the role for men? Well, the chilling answer is none. You're not needed. So, those are the factors, in my view, that have led to the problem. We start with feminism, which becomes enshrined in political thinking, is then worked out in educational policy, and then is also worked out in terms of policy towards family and policy towards employment. Okay? Go on, Steve.
Can I suggest another area?
You can. There's loads of other areas. I've just picked the most obvious.
I'm just thinking that one of the things that goes through this is a certain lack of role model in every level.
Oh, sure.
And actually, I think particularly in education, I go to local people thoroughly in Riley and do some assemblies with them. They have 20 pupils, of which two are girls and 18 are boys, and they have a staff of 11 and 3 office staff, but one is male, or the head teachers are a woman. And actually, you feel kind of sorry for these guys, because when they need big massive rep models, they're just not finding them.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree. Every time. Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I have another
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. PC language.
Sure.
Distinctive. It's great. Yeah. Okay, thank you. That's helpful. So we want to add those certainly to the list in terms of role models and in terms of politically correct approach to the way we speak. That would certainly be an influence. So what's the result of all this then? Let's try and sort of think of some results. First result, men are a danger to society. Let me just put this up because I think this neatly summarises how men are viewed. In terms of what you would read in the press, particularly think of what you read in the press about men, this I think is a fair summary. And you might want to say the press is not the only voice that should be listened to.
Agreed.
But it feeds into the conception, okay? So, here we go. I think these are the three results. Men are viewed thus. Hello, come in. One, they are fundamentally lazy, irresponsible or violent, and given half a chance will abandon their children. Just think of some of the headlines, think of some of the policies, think about what happens and you kind of see what I'm saying. Two, male characteristics such as competition, aggression, hiding their feelings, coupled with men's obsession with work, are the root of all societal problems. Men need to learn to emote. They need to learn to express themselves. And it mustn't be done competitively, and it mustn't be done aggressively, is the constant popping message. Three, men are always the violent victimizers and women the poor victims. So when women behave badly, this is interesting, isn't it? It is often put down to them behaving like men. See the problem? Oh, she's now behaving like a man. As if there's something wrong with that state. The clear inference is that bad behaviour is a male rather than a female characteristic. And if you're interested in following this up, I know you're all busy guys and girls working, but if you really want to follow that up, Google in Erin Pitsey, E-R-I-N-P-I-Z-Z-E-Y, who runs a hostel for battered wives. And I'm pretty sure you'll get some interesting stuff from her, because what she discovered is that actually she was getting a lot of battered husbands coming to her. And when she mentioned that within the feminist movement in which she grew up, there was utter denial. So read her a bit and you'll just see some of the stuff that I've talked about there. So that's the first result, it seems to me. Men are a danger to society. They're a nuisance. Okay? And so that feeds into what I said right at the beginning. This whole notion that being male is some kind of handicap is really where we're at now. Listen to this summary. And I think you've got it, haven't you? Or have you not? Yes, top of the next page, please. Without a job, without a role, outsmarted and outstripped by girls and women, boys and men are said to be resorting to their natural tendencies for rape and pillage. They truant from school, but often humour can reveal what 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 often humour can reveal where a culture is at. So James Dobson lists some jokes about men he came across on the web. Some of them actually made me smile a lot, but just listen to them and get the kind of feel of what's going on here and you'll see what's happening. These are all from one website. One, don't imagine you can change a man unless he's in a nappy. Two, never let your man's mind wander. It's too little to be out alone. Three, definition of a bachelor, a man who misses the opportunity to make some woman miserable. Four, best way to get a man to do something, suggest he's too old for it. Five, if you want a committed man, look in a mental hospital. Six, go for a younger man. You might as well, they never mature anyway. Absolutely. Seven, what's the best way to force a man to do sit-ups? Put the remote control between his toes. Okay, now, it is ongoing abuse, and yet, there's an edge, isn't there? There's a kind of, can you imagine a website dedicated to females on that? You might have a website dedicated to blondes. Mm-hmm. Okay, we know that, but the whole gender? I think they're busy out there. There's ongoing abuse, constantly. More seriously, next result, alarm. Because that's what's happening now. There's kind of rising tide of alarm. What's going on here? What's going to happen? How are we going to deal with these men, these boys that won't grow up, and these young male offenders? How are we going to deal with it? And it comes in a number of ways. First of all, politicians are raising concerns. When Jack Straw was Home Secretary, this is what he said. Dealing with underskilled, undereducated young men is the single most serious problem we face. Interesting word, isn't it? The single most serious problem we face. Recently, a right-wing think tank, the Social Policy Unit, produced a report which described white working class boys as the underclass of our schools. I've already referred to that. That came out just recently. The latest government education report recommends that boys and girls be taught separately in order to help boys close the learning gap. That's a phenomenal statement. What are they saying then about the difference between sexes? So politicians are now deeply concerned about what's going on. Journalists are also declaring that something must be done. The Economist described boys as tomorrow's second sex. And a Times correspondent, you've got the quote here, said this last year: somewhere along the line, we have stripped men of their primary functions and made them miserable. Interestingly, she goes on in the article to define those primary functions as taking responsibility for family and work. Teachers are voicing fears. One London secondary teacher said this: boys feel continually attacked for who they are. We have created a sense in school that masculinity is something bad. Even feminists are now voicing and chorusing concern. Susan Faludi, have you ever come across her, wrote her second, well, one book was very popular, her second most popular book was called Stiffed, and it was about the needs of men. And she claimed men are in agony in that book. Rosalind Coward is worried for her son's generation. She is a feminist. This is what she talks about her son's doing. They are, quotes, thrashing around in a new world in which they feel demoralized, the second sex. So there is alarm now in various quarters about what we've done. So what is the answer then? Not a biblical answer at this point. We're just now trying to expose and deal with what we're seeing. Okay? How are answers given? Well, here's the answer: the Save the Male campaign. Okay? It's as if the feminists and those in government who have swallowed their arguments are now faced with some unwelcome consequences of their campaign. Unfortunately, this did not involve them reconsidering their approach. Rather, they merely applied the same mindset to a new campaign for the stricken male. So back to Faludi again, F-A-L-U-D-I. This is what she says: being a feminist opens your eyes to the ways men, like women, are imprisoned in cultural stereotypes. So she's not shifted at